This is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. I'm Cheryl McQuaid. Also on the team is
Jerry Smith.
We are going to interview three retirees from Fisher Body: Alan Vandevos, Louise Dean, and John Dean. Today is June 14th, Wednesday, and it's approximately 9:15 a.m. We're at the 602 Union Hall back conference room. Alan, can we start with you? Would you state and spell your last name for us?
Alan Vandevos, and it's V as in Victor, A-N-D-E-V-U-S-S-E.
And what is your address, Alan?
5012 Applewood Drive, Lansing, Michigan.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was a chef, and my mother was just a housewife. She died when I was 7 years old, so I was brought up with my grandparents.
And where were you raised?
St. John's, Michigan.
Could you give us a little bit about your educational background?
Well, I graduated from high school in 1949, and I went into the Navy Reserve. Then I hired into American State Bank in 1950, and I left there to go to Fisher Body in 1953. And after that, I took a correspondence course in accounting, and I also took some math courses at MSU and later at LCC.
Do you remember when you hired into Fisher Body? What's your seniority date?
April 13th of 1953.
And where did you hire? What department did you hire into?
Payroll department, as a payroll auditor.
Okay, now we're going to switch to Louise Dean, and I'd like the same information for you, Louise. Could you state your name and spell your last name, please?
My name is Louise Dean. It's D-E-A-N.
And what is your address?
9336 Riverside Drive, Grand Ledge, Michigan.
And do you have children? Are you married?
I'm married with no children.
And where were you born and raised?
Flint, Michigan. Raised in Lansing, Michigan.
What did your parents do?
My father worked for the Flint Journal, and he passed away when I was 8 weeks old. And my mother returned to Lansing, where I was raised here. And she worked for an insurance company.
Could you give us a little bit about your educational level?
I went to school in Lansing, graduated from Sexton High School, and went 1 year at Western Michigan. And then hired into GM in 1963.
What did you do before hiring into Fisher Body? Did you come in right out of school?
No, I went to California for 3 years. Then I came back to Michigan and went to Warren, Michigan, and hired in at the Tech Center, the Turnstead Division of GM. Mm-hmm. Then transferred to Lansing Fisher Body because John and I were getting married in 1966.
Okay, and John, Louise's husband, is here with us. You don't need to address and name spellings all the same, correct?
That's correct. We're not divorced.
Would you state your name and tell us a little bit about where you were born and raised?
Name's John Dean. I was born and raised in Lansing. I went to high school at Everett High School here in Lansing, graduated from there, and went to work at Oldsmobile in 1955 to work there a year. And from there, while I was in high school, as a matter of fact, I was working as an apprentice in the heating business. So I went from there to the heating business for a while, and then I worked at Rail for a while, and back into the heating business, and eventually I got to be a journeyman tinsmith. And I hired into Fisher Body, strictly went there because I wanted the benefits. We didn't have any benefits in the construction industry at that time. And went there to get the benefits, and they wanted me to hire in on skilled trades, and I said, no, I've had enough of that, and I didn't want to work 7 days a week and all that. So that was 1971 when I hired in there. I think it was May 24th or something like that. It was right close to my birthday, I remember that. And when I went to work there, I started going back to school again. So I picked up an associate's degree at LCC then, and then through the course of time, I picked up enough credits to have another year of education. So about 3 years of college is what it amounted to. But the benefits that we had, of course, we don't have as much anymore. But times have changed. But I think that all the jobs I had in there is, I started out working in the paint shop. Matter of fact, Al Vandemus here was one of the first guys I ever worked for. And was in the old Building 9 area, and I worked down there for a few months. And then I went into plant security as a patrolman. And then I went through a pre-supervisory training program and went into plant security as a sergeant. Then back out as a body shop supervisor. Then I went back into plant security for a while again. And then I went back to as a night shift safety coordinator, as engineer. And I came off of that when Joe Birch passed away, and I was made the director of safety. And then I went into plant security as the chief of plant security. And then when they consolidated the two plants here in Lansing, I went down to maintenance as a coordinator of planning with plant engineering. So that kind of sums up my career.
So we're going to do something a little different today. We're going to just kind of do a round table of your memories at the plant. Louise, I did too get your date of hire in, didn't I? You hired in Warren.
63.
And what, when you transferred to Lansing, what department did you transfer to?
To personnel. And while in personnel, I hired in labor relations, and then went to salary personnel, hourly insurance, and safety. All time was spent in personnel.
Was there a dress code when you hired in?
Yes. Dresses.
Dresses. That's that, huh?
Right. No slacks. No pantsuits.
No smoking at your desk.
No smoking at your desk. No coffee. No, you could drink coffee at your desk, but you had to smoke in the lounge.
And Al, do you remember anything about the dress code when you hired in? Was there a dress code?
Oh, yes. For salary, you wore a white shirt and ties. But she was talking about the smoking. Back when I hired in, back at that time, the desk had spittoons next to it.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah. And that's where, when you smoked, we smoked at our desk, and you just threw the butts in the spittoon. And it was probably somewhere around the late 50s where they took those out. And I wish I had one of those old spittoons just as for memorabilia.
Yeah.
But then...
So there was a spittoon by every desk?
Between two desks, there'd be a spittoon. And that was all through the accounting department. So that was quite unique, I thought. Not very sanitary.
You wouldn't see it anymore, would you? You wouldn't see it anymore.
No. But I was surprised to hear Louise say they couldn't smoke at their desk because we always did.
I might say the reverse. You had to smoke down the hall and drink coffee at your desk or drink.
Yeah, well,
smoke at your desk and...
They had lots of restrictions on women. I remember that even when I came there. Lots of things women couldn't do that men could. Yeah. One of them was that men could make more money than women could.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Except on the line. On the line, they
that was different.
Say,
yeah, but
yeah.
Salaried, it was salary horrendous was what they did to women.
Of course, there wasn't, at that time, there wasn't any women in the higher paid jobs at all.
No.
So... I guess you couldn't really compare it.
No, not really.
I think when we interviewed Shirley Sanborn, she had mentioned that salary, you weren't even allowed to talk about how much you made.
That's right.
Oh, no.
Absolutely.
Oh, that was strictly secret.
Very confidential.
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't discuss that at all. Good or bad, I don't know how you'd, you know, classify that. But I know when I got into the higher positions, I had a lot of women working for me. And when I looked at their pay as opposed to the pay of their counterparts in the same jobs, it was ridiculously low. And when you went to the director to find out what's going on here. These women are working as well and doing as good a job as the men. Boy, you got your tail feathers singed right now, I'll tell you. I even went to the plant manager on one situation. They finally relented, but you didn't make any friends doing that, I'll tell you, because they just didn't do it. Women were not to get paid what men got paid. They didn't make any friends. But there was all kinds of stuff. Dress codes were funny for women. I remember one time that, of course, I was chief plant security at the time. One of my female officers, she was a young girl. She came parading through the plant one day, and she had one. Short shorts were popular. And she walked past the personnel director's office. And boy, he was on the phone to me in a hot minute. Said, you get these girls straightened out, you know. And I said, what are you talking about? And I walked over there, sure as the devil, she had on short shorts. Well, so what, you know? Boy, you got to send them home, get different clothes on, and all this and that. They just wouldn't tolerate that stuff, you know. It's weird, you know. Yeah, today, you wouldn't think anything about it.
They did that throughout the plant. I mean, if a gal came in with shorts that were, you know, more than halfway up the upper part of the leg, by gosh, you sent them home. Yeah. They had to get something appropriate on. That was
people didn't like to confront those issues. I know that. I used to get calls when I was on safety on the night shift. Of, you know, I had one guy complaining about, the supervisor complained to me that this girl was working across in the old cushion room, you know, where they, out there at Building 19, yeah, when they had the cushion room out there. And she wasn't wearing any bra. And she had a tank top on, you know, and when she would lean over the line to work with it, she was exposing herself. There was a guy that worked right across the street from her, right across the line from her, that was really upset about this, you know. He was a Christian kid. And so when I went out there, and the supervisor didn't want to address it, you know, and he thought it was a safety issue, so here I am, you know. And so I went to her, and I said, you got to come in the office with me. I got to talk to you. And I talked to the guy, you know, and he was up in the air. My wife and blah, blah, blah. You know, I said, okay. We go in the office, I'm talking to this girl, and I said, you know, I realize it's hot out here, and I know you want to be comfortable in this and that, but you can't expose yourself like this, you know. And she says, I'm not, blah, 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 defending it. And I said, well, you're going to go home, and you're going to put some clothes on. That's all there is to it, because you can't work tonight like that. But anyway, she goes home, and she comes back, and the next day, of course, the union come down and say, you can't do that to our employees. And I said, well, then I'll write a new plant rule, you know. And that's where that one came from, you know, that was, you know, if it's offensive or abusive to other people, you can't wear that type of clothing. That's where that came from.
So you used to write some of the plant rules.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. People didn't like to put things down on paper back then. Man. And the only way I find that you can make people do things or make them even cognizant of what it's supposed to be, but you write it down. You get a bad reputation when you do that, too.
Well, I always remember you having a good reputation, so
well, thank you.
It didn't follow you like that, I don't think, Mr. Dean.
Hard to say. Irregardless, you do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Could you tell us, I think when we interviewed Mr. McGee.
Sam
McGee. Mm-hmm. I believe he was telling us a little bit about the cameras and some of the stuff the plant security had to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you go into the plant security for us?
Well, yeah. Back what Sam was talking about on the cameras was we were probably one of the first plants in Lansing to put up a security surveillance system around the periphery of the plant because we're getting so much damage out in the parking lot. And you used to have enough people to patrol everything continually. So we put cameras up all over the place so you could see the parking lots and you could see the periphery of the plant and so on, you know, and all the monitors were down at the plant security desk. So you could see anything anytime you wanted to, and some of the things you seen you didn't enjoy seeing. But anyway, you know, it was a way to deter theft and damage to people's property and so on. You could also observe some things that you wanted to see that were not too, you know, shouldn't be made public, let me put it that way. But anyway, we used a lot of that stuff. And we used a lot of controls for the periphery of the plant as far as doors and things of that nature, you know, to control people's flow in and out of the plant. They wanted to put in, as a matter of fact, when I went to work there, they had put in the alarm systems at the gates. So, you know, when you walk through, they'd ring a bell if it was a metal object and so on, which at that time, they were unsophisticated, and you couldn't you couldn't temper them down so that it wouldn't trigger at the slightest metal object going through them, see? So it was ridiculous. I mean, they turned those things on. I hadn't been working there, I don't think, 3 months when I was out there, and here this damn thing's going off, you know, and I'm wondering, what in the world is happening here? You know, the guys are carrying metal lunch buckets through there with a gun. So anyway, they unhooked those very, very quickly so that, yeah, they never were used. Now, you probably, when you went to work there, you probably see them sitting out there because they never did take them out. They just sat there for a long time. Well, now, of course, they went to these swinging gates and all that stuff that you were prevalent when you went to work there. And, you know, they had the punch cards and all that stuff. Well, these things that I'm talking about were the forerunner of all that stuff, see, to secure the plant. But, you know, the biggest thing that we had as far as security goes was the patrolling of the plant, and all that really was a deterrent to people doing things so that they were conscious that there was somebody there to do it. All plant security really was an observing and reporting organization. It was up to guys like Al to control their people. All we did was hand him reports that your guys did this, you know, and it's our word against yours, you know, and do what you will with your people, you know. Because we didn't have the right to arrest or anything like that. We just report what we've seen, you know. And a lot of people thought the plant security people were cops. They weren't cops. You know, they were observers and reporters and controllers. And that's all it amounted to. You know, and we had some guys that thought they were cops. There's no question about it. But believe me, they were far
greater.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. But you know, it was tough to get it across to those people because they'd get abuse like there was no tomorrow. There was no two ways. But I remember when I was an officer, you walk around that plant. God, I'd have guys challenging me nightly, you know, they take you out and kick your tail and all this and that, and I, you bet, you know. But, you know, it's part of the game. But one of the most important things the plant security had was the fire protection systems, you know, and the people we had control and all that stuff, because they were vital. Particularly, you take, like, in that paint shop that Al had, I mean, one spark up there, boy, and maybe it'd go up just like a candle, you know. So you had to keep everything under control and working condition and so on, and the priority alarm systems we had there, you know, we were continually working on that stuff because he had dry systems up there because a lot of the paint shop area was open to outside air, and therefore you can't have water in a line because it freezes and breaks. So you had these dry systems, and you had these valves inside the main lines and so on that had to be checked, and so if they weren't operating, the alarm would go off down at the desk, then you got to get them repaired. You can't have those things shut off, so... You know, with a building that big or a facility that large, you can't have all these things shut down. So you got to constantly be monitoring that stuff to make sure it's working. But that was a biggie. And, of course, we had a guy on each shift to control that, you know, and to work with it and so on. And we had maintenance people specifically assigned to us so we'd keep that stuff operational. You didn't want to burn the place down no matter what.
And it sounds like that was...
That was
easy to do.
Well, believe me, we had some dandies there at Sam's. scary fires.
Yep. Alan, Jen brought up the paint shop. Why don't you talk a little bit about the paint shop? You were there when it went from the old paint shop to the new shop, didn't you?
Yep.
Weren't you?
When I first went to Fisher Body, the paint shop was a one-line system through the sealer room, and then it split a head of wet sand. And then it was a two-line system, and we built all convertibles on the one line and closed bodies on the other line. And that was before we went into, oh, goodness,
yeah.
the postless cars, you know, where when you opened the windows, it was all open. What do you call those?
Yeah.
I can't even remember
now either.
Anyway,
more posts, we just open all the way across.
Yeah, yeah. And then when we came out with the F-85 in 1961, we went from a that's a convertible.
Oh, okay.
But the cars, we had a two-door and had also a four-door that had a roof on it, but it was all open across, just like a convertible. The windows rolled down in the back and down here. And I was going to say, in 1961, when we started building the F-85, it was called at that time, that eventually became the Cutlass, Then it was a two-line system all the way through the paint shop, and we had to build some additional spray booths because they had a painted interior on them. Then, we continued that paint shop until we moved up into the new paint shop in 1984 when we started building the GM20 program. There was a lot of changes in between, but minor changes, like every year they'd come in and do something minor, but that old paint shop, like I say, lasted a lot of years. It was there long before I was, and up until, like I say, 1984. That's kind of a brief history of the paint shop, as I recall it.
Do you remember any of your headaches from having that old of a paint shop?
Oh, all the time. John was talking about his safety and the fire protection. One of the big problems in the paint shop was contamination from a silicone base, like hand creams that had a silicone base. And we got plagued with the fish eyes, they call them, from a silicone-based material or a powder. And we couldn't find that and couldn't find it. And finally, it was coming over a wall from a room where they filled fire extinguishers.
What is a fisheye?
Well, it's just a little imperfection in the paint, but it's kind of a, like if you get an oil spot on something, it's just hard to get out. I mean, you can sand the hell out of it.
It's a pit or a bubble.
Yeah, and you'd sand it right down to the bare metal, and you'd spray it again, and the darn thing would pop right through again.
You know where the main aisle was in Building 1, right where Building 9 offices are?
Yeah.
You come out that far north door there, yeah. It'd be the northeast door, out of Building 9.
Yeah.
Right there was where the old fire hall was. Okay, and that's where they had the fire trucks and stuff, and that's where we filled extinguishers. On the other side of that wall was his paint shop.
that powder just floated out over this brick wall, and my God, we just had an awful time finding that.
Well, we had the same problem when we went in the new paint shop, because people would want to, you know, screw around, they'd touch off one of those fire extinguishers up there, go near,
We had constant problems in the paint shop. They were the booth cleaners occasionally would leave a door open up on the roof at an oven. Well, then you'd get contamination through the outside air, the dust and everything. Paint shop was a constant battle. And it was always our fault, no matter what happened. If the body shop had a problem, the paint shop was supposed to fill it with sealer or something, you know, fix it up for them.
If the trim
shop had a problem, it was about the paint shop's fault because they had too much sealer in a window opening, or it was a constant battle.
See, coming up out of the body shop, the last thing they do is grind on these things. Yeah. It'd be lead grinding, see, and you're supposed to go through a washer and take that stuff off. They get up to the paint shop and go around that marshaling area up there and then ship them down into paint, see? And man, that stuff would be on that car. He's trying to get it off through the Bondurant area and it won't come off.
It was a constant battle.
And it was just always, and people, I can remember Al and I walking on housekeeping tours up there and people cooking. Damn oven, grease splattering off and stuff, popcorn machines going, grease on everything.
In the old paint shop, on the night shift occasionally, like at a holiday period, somebody would get the idea that, and they actually put a pig in an oven.
Yeah.
And they thought they had it all covered up with tinfoil, but my God, all of a sudden the car started coming out just splattered with grease from this pig being baked in the oven. I'll tell you, if you go back in the 50s, the supervisors back then, of course, were taken from the line, and they were buddies with the people on the line, and you can't imagine how many whiskey bottles
Oh,
and you know that type of stuff that we took out even foreman's lockers.
Oh, you bet.
Because they were all buddy-buddy, you know, and especially the night shift. The day shift wasn't quite so bad because there were a lot of people around watching, but that night shift was something else.
Oh, even when I went there, we used to, when the body shop was down there on along Verlinden Avenue in 3X, I can remember us guys, I'd put a patrolman out there in the front of the building, you know, on the night shift. And here would come a rope out through the window, you know, and guy'd tie on a six-pack. All kinds. And the same thing would happen out, you know, where the executive drive was, the executive garage for the trim shop, right behind the trim shop. You'd see him out there throwing stuff over the fence, you know, and guys running out there grabbing it, you know, and back into the place. Hey, it was just, you know, just the way things were. But I know when I first went to work there, drinking was very, very prevalent in that shop. I mean, I know even, you know, salaried people having bars set up in their areas and you name it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It was different.
And then after the drinking, you know, that got under control pretty much. But then drugs entered drugs into the picture, and that was a worse thing than the drinking, because it was harder to control.
The alcohol, we finally did get that under control, you know, but that drug thing, that was just pretty wild. I don't mean maybe you could see it, you knew it, you know, and you could even, I had lists of people that were involved in that stuff, you know, but to do something about it was very, very difficult. And you know, you try to get help from, you know, the union guys and so on. They put their foot in a noose, you know, or their neck in a noose. They're not going to do that, you know. And so you just kind of had to temper it as best you could, you know. And it led to some quality problems. It led to some, you know, safety issues. It led to a lot of things.
Yep.
And, you know, you just did what you could do to help the situation as best you could. And there wasn't a whole lot you could do. We had some police working in there at one time, and we had done a lot of things in that, you know, in those regards to try to control that. Even had police in the parking lots at times, because I mean, those cameras were part of that issue. I mean, you could sit there and watch the dealings going on, you know. You knew who it was, you know, and you could show it to the cops, but they can't do anything on private property until they get off private property, you know. So there were a lot of issues like that, but It caused problems. There are no two ways about it. We could have had a far better quality job coming out of there over the years if it hadn't been for alcohol and drugs.
So it was a major problem, then.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sure was.
Constantly.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like Al was talking about the food and stuff, you know, in that band. If you wanted to have an experience, you wanted to come into Fisher Body on Friday night at about 7 to 9 o'clock at night, any place in there, you walk through that place, and you'd smell fish, popcorn, pizza. And, of course, back then, you know, the plant rules was you couldn't have coffee pots, you couldn't have radios, you couldn't be cooking in the plant, you know, none of that stuff, you know. And, of course, the plant security guys were responsible for finding that stuff and reporting it to the supers and all this, you know. And you didn't want to step on the people's throat. You know, it was bad enough being in there on a Friday night. But on the other hand, that was your job, you know, and it was a plant rule. Radios, my gosh, you couldn't have a radio, you couldn't have nothing, you know, it was just awful. But then, you know, over the years, they relented on some of that stuff. But I remember getting calls from Tom Weathor at the plant manager, get down there, get that situation straight. He went through that cushion room one night, and he was just going crazy, you know, because there was all this country western music going. I mean, you couldn't hear yourself think down there, you know. So Russ was the safety guy on the day shift, and I said, come on, Russ, you're going, you know, went down there with a noise meter, you know. And I said, okay, you guys, you're over the decimal limits, turn them down. It was awful. But they finally relented on that stuff. You know, you could have coffee pots, and if they were in their proper area and all that, and same way the radios and all that crap, you know, but it was years. Boy, I mean, we used to burn a lot of people just for having that stuff around. You know, it was not to be.
And even after they relented on those things, there again, the paint shop couldn't have the you know, the coffee pots and that because of the contamination. And so those people were kind of discriminated against.
Well, remember that time we found that deodorants were causing problems in the paint shop?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just
anything that, like I say, that would have a a silicone type base to it, like I say, perfumes and any kind of makeups that
we even found one problem one time with the shipping aids for the grommets and so on. They're coming in with a powdery substance. Contaminated the paint. Now, that's why in hazardous materials we'd look get data sheets on all that stuff, and you know, you could just look it up, you know, and sure as heck that'd be the problem, you know. I remember one several times that they'd have compressor problems over in the powerhouse. And Al would call up, your filter's up there going crazy, you know, this and that. Well, it's, you know, what he was talking about was the air supply houses up on the roof, see. When they change the filters up there, a lot of time they'd knock a lot of stuff loose, you know, and the next morning, boy, you turn that line on, they'd have pits and crap in the paint job like there was no tomorrow. Well, I said, we didn't change any filters this time, you know, and we didn't do nothing. Well, come to find out, what they'd done is they'd over in the powerhouse, they had changed their filtration over there on the air supply system, and they had even oiled up their equipment. He was suffering the effects because it went through the air supply lines into the paint shop. He's got a mess.
Everything affected the paint department.
Yes, it was. It was, like I say, a constant battle all the time. Because the least little, if you had a little breakdown in an oven, you know, which we had occasionally, a body truck would come off the line for some reason. It was a piece of metal or something in the track, and it shake the oven. Well, my God, then for hours you had dirt because it just shook it all loose.
And well, that and the people going in there themselves.
People going in to fix the, you know, to take care of the breakdown. And
a lot of times they'd scrap jobs right and left because they just couldn't save them, you know, after that contamination was in there.
And he was saying about getting calls from Tom Weathorn. Of course, did you know Tom Weathorn?
I believe he worked there when I did, but he wasn't around.
Plant manager,
well, Tom Weathorn was a kind, he spent his Sundays in the plant. And
dedicated guy.
Yeah, that was his life, and that's where he was at, and many a Sunday mornings I'd get a call. Al, come on down here, I'll just show you something. Well, after about a few months of that, my wife had answered the phone. She said, well, Tom, he isn't here. He's in church. And I think after that, he's going out to breakfast with some people. So she got where she'd make excuses for me. Cause, I mean, he just wanted company, really.
That's what it was. He loved that.
He just wanted somebody
in there
to walk around the plant with him, you know, so he could point things out.
Yeah, he loved that. Man, he'd come by my office and he'd grab me and we're going to go for a walk. You know, and all you did is you'd take your little pad with you and write down all his comments because he had something to say about everything. There was a plant manager that was hands-on. Everything. And he expected you to be an authority on everything, too. But he was the kind of guy, he was, what do I want to say, a dominant individual, very dominant. And to the point that he was a dictator. He'd not only point the problem out to you, he'd tell you how he wanted it corrected.
Mr. Weathorn could write beautiful letters.
He could jot off 3-4 letters a day.
He's the one who told me to start writing stuff down, writing processing procedures. He didn't want to hear about it anymore. He wanted to see it. Yes, sir.
Well, you know, I had experiences too because I was a time study person for a number of years.
Now, time study. Could you explain what a time study person is?
Well, when I first started, we had a single stopwatch and a board of the single stopwatch on it. And you'd go out and you'd write down the elements of a job. Mm-hmm. Like if you were putting sealer on the body in the paint shop, you'd write down what they were, where it was being applied, and you'd time each little segment of the job. And then this was a requirement in our plant that every job in the plant would be studied every year. And it took the first 2-3 months of the new model run to get all the studies of everybody. And of course people used to kind of resent us and they'd drag their feet and
Well, there was walk and carrying time. you had it, all the elements.
Yeah, you break it right down to as fine an element as you could time. And they were useful in a lot of cases, and it didn't just work for the company. I recall one time at a gentleman that was at that time, who later became a paint superintendent, Bob Brown. He called me one day and he said, this young lady just has got a problem. And he said, she can't get her job done, and she wants you to come out and study it. So I went out, and when I studied it, I told Bob, I said, well, she really has got too much work. She can't keep up. So we had to break the job up. So it did help the person sometimes, too. More for the company than the line worker, but it did help them on occasions. And that was, we had a book in the office, and I had every job on a sheet of paper. It was a flip paper that we went through. And at that time, I knew everybody's job. If you walked up to me and said, what does Jane Doe do out there? I could tell you exactly what she did. And that was my job. And make recommendations on, of course, how you could save money, how you could reduce manpower, how you could do a job better, more efficiently. Now, you brought up ergonomics. Now, at that time, we didn't even think about that.
No.
That was not an issue at all. It was just how to do the job more efficiently, and that was the job. The same way, you know, back when I hired in, I went into payroll. I talked about knowing every job in a paint shop. I knew that well. When I hired into payroll, I had the cushion room and the Building 5 paint, which had, at that time, a polish line and a repair line. And after, a few weeks, my boss at that time said, okay, come on, I want you to tell me who these people are. You had to go out and tell him, go down the line and say, well, this is Jane, and that's Bob, and this is Joe, and that's, you know, you had to know everybody's name. That was a criteria. That was something, by God, you had to do. And so you, like I say, you learned how to remember people, and you remembered after that how to remember everybody's job, what they were doing. And at that time also, I used to go in and spray jobs, so I'd know what the job was, or I'd put sealer on the job. And the people were very cooperative. They all used to call me Little Al. Here comes Little Al.
Girls like you better.
Yeah. Pardon me?
John said the girls liked you best.
Oh, well.
And back then, there was two areas that were loaded with women. One was the sealer line, and the other was the cushion room. Boy, yeah. I'm telling you, there used to be some time.
Well, see, we had cut and sew. When I first went there, they had a cut and sew department, and they made all the trim, the seat covers, and the side panels for the doors and all that. We made that right in our plant. Well, then they sent that down to Willow Run into a centralized cut and sew department. And, of course, the cut and sew department was primarily all female. So those ladies had to go, you know, filter into other departments. And paint shop was the biggest recipient. They picked up most of the females that came out of the cut and sew department. That and the cushion room also took part of them. So that's how, really, well, when I first went on supervision out of labor standards into the paint shop, I went on as a supervisor, a line supervisor, and I had 40 women working for me. And there were probably four or five men was all, but the whole line was women.
And that was approximately what year? Do you remember when you went
1966.
Into... 1966. That was in 66, a lot of women.
Oh, yes.
Oh, when I went there in 71, that Kushner was all women. And they had men supervisors.
Yeah.
They had women. Women. And that sealer line, I'm going to say, was 90% women.
Yeah, yeah.
How many female supervisors back then?
None.
You didn't get into that until the 80s.
Yep. No, we didn't have any...
See, it's like when Al was talking about ergonomics and safety. See, those were non-issues. Yeah. They didn't exist. Yeah. And I remember when I went in the safety department, you know, as a night shift rep, most hated person in the world because they didn't know safety. They didn't care. They didn't want it, you know. Well, they didn't want it because they didn't understand it. They thought it was a hindrance to production, you know. And the white-shirted people were the worst of the bunch. Yeah. The hourly rates, you know, they were after it, you know. But they wanted to use it from the standpoint of a better job, you know, get something for themselves out of it, you know, rather than eliminate the condition. You know. And Russ Bauer, at the time I went on, when I went on as director, Russ was just coming on as the UAW rep for the safety. And we'd go out and we'd look at some of these situations, you know, and it was god-awful. I mean, they'd have a little woman like, you know, 3 foot tall working up here on a line, you know, and they'd wonder why she was hurting, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it was, you know, you tell somebody, she can't work like that or he can't work like that. And all he cares is his job, you know.
what John's saying, you know, short people. We had some short people, but we hired short people years ago because when they went through the water test up in Trim, they'd climb in the trunk and ride through the water test in the trunk with their flashlight to see if there was any leaks. And they specifically hired shorter people to do this job.
Yep.
And then they quit doing that. They went to a black light, what they called a black light system. And so they didn't need these people anymore. So therefore, we got them in other jobs in the plant. And like John was saying, I had one real short lady that you just had an awful time finding a job she could do because she was so short.
You wouldn't believe what it took to get a platform built so a person didn't have to stand there on tiptoes to do the job. It was just, everybody's had complete disregard for safety.
Yep.
And the employees were as bad as the salaried people because, you know, they didn't know what was going on. They had no idea, no conception of what that was all about. You know, you try to say, well, you know. But then as you got it going, as you got the safety process going in people's mind, it took a lot of beating up of a lot of people. You know, it took a lot of beating up of myself. I know that. Because people didn't like you, you know. They started misusing it. Look at all the fans at Fisher Body? I mean, every job had a fan for it, you know. And some of it was all right, some of it wasn't. See, they wanted to use safety as the issue to get a fan for personal cooling, you know. And it really wasn't. It was just, you know, I just tell the supervisor when I go up there, and Bauer would do the same thing, you know. This isn't a safety issue, it's a comfort issue. Do you want your employee to have it or don't you, you know? And so they started a stamp system. If we felt it was a safety issue, you know, like fumes or something to be dispersed, we'd stamp the work order. If not, then it was just a comfort thing, you know. And so it was just crazy back in those days. You know, finally, they just put them up wherever they wanted them, you know. And you've seen thousands of them up there. I'm sure you have. But yeah, that was just one thing. But, I mean, it was just ungodly to try to get a safety program going in that plant. And we finally did. It finally started taking hold. And I always felt that the only way he's going to make it work in there. And when I left safety, I told him that you ought to get the hourly rated people involved. Yeah, they'll be the driving force. That's all there is to it. And if you're just going to rely on two salaried guys and one guy from the UAW working on it, it ain't going to work. You know, because you're going to be the bad guys and all the other guys will be the good guys. So you got to get the good guys involved in it, you know. Well, they finally did. And it took off from there. But it was like pulling teeth for a lot of years.
Well, you know, in that same vein, back when I hired in 1953, you know, a shop job was the lowest thing you could do. I mean, back then, if you went to work for Fisher Body on the line, I mean, that was because you couldn't get anything else. Well, you saw the transformation from being an undesirable job to being, boy, I wish I could get in there because the pay is good and the working conditions were so much better and everything because as the years went along, these changes happened and it made it from a sweatshop and a hellhole into a desirable place to work. And it was quite refreshing just to go through that transformation. So it was.
No, I remember going in the body shop, you know, back then. And, it, you know, all that welding going on, there was a lot of people down there then. It wasn't all equipment then. And, man, the smoke would be so thick down there you couldn't see straight, you know. And when I went into safety, I found out why it was that way. Because they damaged the air handling units during the winter to get warm, you know. And therefore, when it comes summertime, you know, it's so doggone hot and that smoke would just hang in there. It's because the air handling units were destroyed, you know, and they weren't functional. So therefore, they wouldn't pull that stuff out of there, you know. So it was just a constant campaign to get maintenance, to go down there and get the body shop supervisors to handle the situation, you know, for their own employees. Get the smoke out of here, you know. The equipment was there. They just didn't maintain it. And it was just unbelievable. But nobody cared. You know, it was just, I mean, you could see smoke and soot hanging in the air down there. If you ever remember walking through the body shop when the changeover came and they'd be washing down all that stuff, that smoke and soot would be that thick all over everything up there.
Yeah, how thick is that?
It's about a quarter of an inch to half an inch. Yeah, it was just laying that stuff, you know. But people didn't seem to care. They just didn't, you know. And it was just, I remember when we started the solder grinding program, you know. People were, you know, going down the hospital, get their blood levels checked for lead. And the lead was a serious problem. And, geez, they'd be elevated way up to, beyond reason. Well, part of it was misuse by people, but they'd carry the cigarettes in their shirt pockets, you know. Yeah. And the lead dust would go in there, you know, and they'd smoke their cigarettes, and, of course, it'd be contaminated. Well, once we got the program going, you know, and they got hoods on these people, and we were washing the hoods, and we were doing all the good stuff to take care of the lead problem, and we had signs on the doors telling them what to do, and all this, well, the lead levels went right down where they should be, and they were abnormal, you know, and so on. All of a sudden, started getting a rash of high lead levels again. I couldn't figure out why, because we were doing all the same stuff, you know. I got out of the hospital one night, and looking at this guy, his level is way high, you know. And I said, what do you do at home? He said, well, he says, I repair automobiles. And I said, what do you wash parts with? Gasoline. And I said, oh. Come to find out, what he's doing is washing parts in gasoline. Of course, gasoline's got lead in it. It absorbs into his skin. It had nothing to do with the plant. And then we got to figuring out that if a guy wanted out of booth, because the booth grinding job was not a desirable job to have, you know, they'd do something like that. Because, you know, if your level was high, we'd have to take you out of the booth, put you on another job until you got the level back down, and the seniority would put you back in there. See? Like, people are clever, believe me. But no, it was just something. It was interesting. As I always said, Fisher Body was a city within a city. And, you know, you just had to look at it from that point of view, you know, that you had all kinds of human elements in there and different types of people, and there was a lot of nepotism in Fisher Body. I mean, you know, you would be surprised how many people were related to other people that knew other people. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
And that was good and bad in a lot of respects, because you when I never had my son came to work there, but he never worked for me or anything, but I think that a person that their child comes to work there, that child has something to live up to, you know. They can't be the hell raiser and that, because their dad or their mother is there and they're watching them. So it helped in that regard. And it was a close-knit area. Even though we had, at one time, 5,000 people, you know, at Fisher Body. And my gosh, you know, you just about knew everybody. Even though there was that many people, and I had the fortune or misfortune of going on nights occasionally and working with the night shift, and like we've said, you get to know the people there, but it was a different life on the night shift. You just went, just like they say, from night to day, because it was entirely different. And I think the people on the night shift were even closer than the people on the day shift, really. But like John said, it was a city within a city and a real experience. So.
Yeah, you should have attended some of the staff meetings we had on issues with dope. Oh. You know, here you're sitting there and everybody in that room is related to somebody, you know.
We're going to take a short break now.
Sure.
Yeah, you want me to repeat that?
Yeah, tell us that story.
The offices for the personnel department and the cafeteria was in the basement, where later there was a marshaling area for the body shop down there after that, after they tore that out and built a new cafeteria upstairs in Building 9.
Yeah.
And the ladies every year, hourly and salary, would put on a fashion show. And it was, and also a talent show. They'd have people come in the cafeteria down there, and they'd have a fashion show and a talent show. And I can't remember any. The one gal was married to a sober. What was her name? She was the clerk.
Lillian.
She was part
Lillian
of it.
Lillian Callermutter.
Yeah, and sober, and about four other names.
Sova?
Sova, yeah.
Not sober.
Not sober, Sova, yeah. He was a...
Country Western.
Yeah. But that was, you know, there was so many... It was like your home. The Fisher Body at that time was not
family
a second affair. Home. It was almost your...
It was
almost your first home. And... because you spent so much time there, and there was activities like that, like I was saying, between the office buildings and the old paint job back in the early 50s. Between there was the grassed areas, and they had horseshoe pits in there where the hourly rate and the salary people would go out there at noontime during lunch periods and play horseshoes, and they had contests and tournaments and everything back there at that time. Well, then that was all filled in, and the garage was put in there, and then the other part was built into the paint shop. And also there was a conference room. Remember the conference room that was back there, John?
Yep, sure do.
And but
if you remember that area, Al, that later became a maintenance storage area for equipment stuff for a lot of years. And plant security was on the other side of the aisle from the main entrance.
Yep.
They moved over to that area and boxed in an area and put their security system in there and so on. Then they moved that junk out of there that was down to that storage area for maintenance, and they made it into a office area for when they started having the UAW people have offices and so on.
Yeah,
at the far end of that area was a tunnel that used to went all the way up to the building two office area, up to Weathorn's office and the plant manager's office.
Yeah.
I remember when we backfilled that in the 80s, you know, it was all filled in with sand and everything so that we could build the new trim shop over there in Building 15.
Yeah.
It was just a lot of changes took place back then.
Well, I know that you do have another appointment, and I really appreciate all the time you've spent with us this morning. And if you would like to come back and spend some more time with us,
sure.
I know that we have only gotten the tip of your stories and memories.
Okay.
So I really thank you both.
Yes,
thank you
all.
Thank
you very much.
Okay.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Enjoy.